You're listening to a talk by Dr. Vandana Shiva, a physicist, social activist, and environmentalist from India, who spoke at Washington State University on Wednesday, November 5th, 2008.
And all of these shifts in the people's rights to food worldwide has meant that people are spending more. The prices worldwide have significantly increased from 2004 to 2006. In 2007 and 8, they shot up even more because of the investment aspect. Corn prices in those 3 years rose by 54%, wheat by 34%, soy oil by 71%, sugar by 75%. Of course, now with the financial unraveling, the commodity prices have come down, but food prices have not. The poor are still spending a huge amount of food. And who's driving this? The corn merchants are the same agribusiness that shaped an industrial agriculture. They're Cargill, ADM, Conagra. For seeds, it's Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta. For palm oil, which is deforesting the Indonesian rainforests, and from the United Nations assessments, by 2030, all of the rainforests of Borneo could be gone with the expansion of palm oil. One would imagine the Indonesians control palm oil. Cargill controls that too. Soya trade, it's Bunge, ADM, Cargill, Louis Dreyfus. Seeds, again, Monsanto, DuPont. So if you really want to understand the roots of the world food crisis, I think one needs to kind of go back to many of the sneezes that took place in this country over time. Some spread beyond the borders, others stayed here. The Green Revolution was the first attempt at expanding the control of US agribusiness over agriculture in other countries. The interesting name really did not come out because green was popular in those days. It wasn't even in the vocabulary in 65. You know, green is a very recent word in defining the environmental movement after the Green Party rose to power in Germany. The word green was merely just another color different from red. And red was the terror in China. Because China had gone red, India had to be prevented from growing red. And the analysis was fascinating because they said, if we do not make peasants rich, peasants are going to have a revolution and they'll go the communist way. So we've got to make them rich and we've got to bring them into a very commercial agriculture. The assumption was if you make agriculture capital intensive, peasants get rich. Again, the sums don't work out. If I spend more, do I get poorer or do I get richer? A capital-intensive agriculture means more poverty, more indebtedness, more loss of land, more creation of landlessness. So they kind of forgot about the debt part, just as recently they forgot that you can't, if you know, you put all of society on a credit spending, sooner or later you'll get into trouble. That's what the whole Wall Street collapse was about, living on credit. The Green Revolution was about credit, and they forgot that sooner or later this is not going to work. But 1965, a drought was used to impose this industrial agriculture on India. Nobody accepted it, except one man who had friends in the World Bank. And they worked it out. So don't worry, forget democracy, forget the parliament, forget even the prime minister of that time, Lal Bahadur Shastri. Now, I got interested in this issue because in 1984, we had the worst violence in the state of Punjab. The state of Punjab was the richest state in India. But people were turning to extremism and terrorism. 30,000 people were killed. And the result of it was, you know, the army and police had to take over the state. I have often said Punjab was 9/11, but the world did not, was six times 9/11, but the world did not notice. I'm a physicist, and to me, there were just two questions in my mind that I had to answer. The first was, if the Nobel Prize was given to Norman Borlaug for creating the Green Revolution, how come Punjab was not a land of peace but became a land of war? What went wrong? And the second was, if Punjab was really that wealthy, why were the people so angry? And by the end of it, I kind of figured out what this thing called the Green Revolution was and wrote a book for the United Nations called The Violence of the Green Revolution, and understood then that the roots of hunger were built into it. The first level of hunger was created because actually the Green Revolution, contrary to the popular explanation, was not producing more food. Now, everyone says this is what got India out of famine, this is the secret to India moving from what they call a ship-to-mouth existence. None of it was true. We hadn't had a famine in 65. We'd had a drought, very different. Famine, people die of lack of food. Drought, the rain drops a little bit. And in this region, I'm told you're in the rain shadow, a drought is something that farmers deal with. By the time I'd finished my study, I'd realized per acre we were producing less food. Per acre we were producing less food, but we were producing more commodities. We were producing more rice and wheat that the farmers sold. But we were producing no lentils, no dals, no pulses, no legumes, no oilseeds, none of the mixed agriculture that is required for a full food security in our kind of context of primarily vegetarian diet. If you look at the nutritional per acre or food per acre output, it had dropped dramatically. But the second level at which hunger was being created by the system was when farmers have to take credit to buy the chemicals, they have to sell what they grow to pay that credit back. So ultimately, chemical industrial farmers under conditions of poverty never eat what they grow. They're selling everything. And that's what explains this crazy situation of today, that most of the hungry people of the world are actually rural agricultural producers. This is new. Hunger used to be an urban affair. When in 1942, with the Great Bengal Famine, 2 million people died in Bengal because the British took every bit of rice and exported it. It wasn't that we didn't have enough rice in the country, but all of it was exported for the war. All those 2 million, most of the 2 million were in the cities. They weren't in the villages. But today, the 1 billion who go hungry in the world are primarily in rural areas. Primarily in rural areas. And that's because these agricultural systems, on the one hand, constantly take away from the producer what the producer has grown, or after some amount of indebtedness, take away from the producer the very land on which you could have a livelihood or produce your food. With the second big sneeze from the United States that gave the world a huge food insecurity influenza was the World Trade Organization. And we've had trade before. You know, India exported spices centuries and centuries ago. Even poor Columbus was actually seeking India spices. He lost his way and came to this country. And therefore, the Native Americans have always been called Indians because of his error of where he landed. But it was looking for spices. And Columbus was entering the spice trade because we had the trade anyway. In the literature, I have read that a bag of pepper, black peppercorn, used to be exchanged for an equal weight in gold. A sack of gold for a sack of corn, or peppercorn. And so that's what the trade was about. But the new trade embodied in the World Trade Organization is very different. In my long exploration of Pullman, I did visit the museum, the art museum, and Esther took me there for this wonderful exhibition of Native American rugs. And I was quite interested because, you know, they call them trade rugs. So the words kind of, I wanted to figure out why they call trade rugs. Of course, figured out that these rugs used to be then by then manufactured and give, you know, exchanged for fur. And for example, the Hudson Bay Company started getting into the manufacture of rug. And that's why they were called trade rugs. And the exhibition starts with a fascinating little statement saying, there will be trade when there is excess of resources and products. With, if you look at the trade driven by the World Trade Organization today, it is not trade in an excess. It is trade that is creating a deficit. It is, that's why I have called it not free trade, it is forced trade. You're forced to engage in it against your sovereign decisions. But who made the decisions? Who made the decisions of WTO? You know, before WTO, there was created at the same time when, you know, they're going to meet on 15th of November for what they call Bretton Woods II. Bretton Woods I was organized during the war, you know, 1944. They could figure out the old order is crumbling, just like they're figuring it now, the old order is crumbling, and you've got to create a new one or prevent a genuinely new one from getting emerged. So, you know, 44, the war's on, countries are seeking freedom, my own country, Gandhi has given the call in 42 to British quit India, and by 47 we get independence. And that was happening everywhere. So you could see that the world will now have political independence, the old empire will not run. So as they said, the money men of the world met. You know? They call themselves the money men of the world. And the money men of the world will meet again, 15th of November, to figure out, you know, how do you keep control over the world when you're losing control over the world? The Bretton Woods institutions, World Bank, IMF, were created as part of that, and a third little twin called the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which should have become a trade institution, but didn't, partly because the first meeting was in Havana, and you know, the U.S. has always had problem with anything in Havana. So the Havana Charter and the Havana model was never adopted till 1995, we get the World Trade Organization. Now, I was very fortunate that I happened in 87 to be invited to a meeting in Geneva. I had no idea all this was going on. But the corporations were all there. And they talked about how they would have a new world order on food. And they laid out their dream. And their dream was only genetically engineered seed, all seeds patented, and total global integration of the food system. I've spent my life defending biodiversity, the integrity of life, the intrinsic value of every species, every person, every race, every gender. And the idea of ownership over life was just, you know, for me, like the, you know, a red blanket in front of the bull. But also the idea that life would be patented meant now it was being assumed that life is a creation of corporations. But it's not. It's scientifically not true. Life makes itself. That's what's so beautiful about life. You put a little seed into the soil and it makes itself. You know, doesn't need permission from Monsanto. Can I grow now? Can I turn left for the sunshine? Can I turn right? It just grows. Grows with the elements, it grows with the soil, with the sunshine. So the idea that seeds would now be treated as the invention of corporations. Untruth, and that's the second thing that really stirs me. I can't deal with untruth. I just can't deal with it, yeah. You want to get me really engaged, tell a lie. And it seemed half my life, you know, I'm spending so much time just saying, no, it's not true that the Green Revolution produced more food. And it's not true that a seed is an invention. A seed is the embodiment of millennia of years of evolution of that species and centuries of the interaction between human intelligence, the farmers, their breeding. Industrial breeding is very recent, and it can just sort of tinker a little bit. Even when they shift genes around and create genetically engineered organisms, which is when the pattern started, it's a bit like, you know, bringing this chair into this hall. You bring a gene from one organism to another, you bring a gene, a chair from one building to another. Does this movement of the chair turn into the construction of this building? Doesn't, isn't. Just a movement of a chair. It's a shuffling of furniture. Genetic engineering is a shuffling of genes. You know, you should be putting U-Haul every time they do genetic engineering. That's all they're doing. Getting a trailer. The trailer in this case is a gene gun, and they just shoot. But how can you then say you've created the whole thing, and not just the whole thing, but generations and generations of its capacity to multiply, reproduce, be its own thing? When, in fact, when they did, remember the Dolly episode? Yeah? Dolly, yeah, again, that's another sneeze. Yeah. Another US sneeze. You had a Dolly Parton. So in Edinburgh, they call a poor clone sheep Dolly. And she was considered second creation. And Ian Wilmot, the scientist who had cloned her, and again, talking about cloning, what did he really do? He took two cells and took out the nucleus of one and then just shot it with electric currents till something fused. And one of them, one of the 273, ended up being a sheep, whom he named Dolly. The other 272 were mutants. I wrote an article in those days called What Happened to Dolly's 272 Sisters. When Dolly, of course, was supposed to be this miracle factory forever producing pharmaceuticals in her milk. They had a patent on her. She was now going to be the property of Protein Pharmaceuticals Limited. And the patent was for a mammalian bioreactor. Mammary glands used to produce chemicals, which of course, interestingly, never said only in the sheep, so it would actually cover the human too. Dolly's in a museum. Protein Pharmaceuticals is closed. And the second creation did not work. But it doesn't matter how many experiments go wrong. Monsanto, along with a group of companies, realize there's big money in this. There's big money if you can own and control life, because landlords only take rents on land and buildings. Life lords take rents out of every generation of reproduction of a species. And then if you have in your hands the power to terminate reproduction, which is what the Terminator technology is about. Can you imagine what a rich life lord you will be? So Monsanto with others got together and wrote a treaty called the Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. My government, led by an amazing man who I work very closely with, S.P. Shukla, said, but you know, this is nothing to do with trade. How we give patents, how we assign copyright is something about domestic decision making. This is not about trade. So the US lawyers in Washington just went back and put TR before IP, and that's why it's called the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. What a mouthful. I call it the Monsanto Treaty. The Monsanto Treaty and its key article is an Article 27.3b, which allows Monsanto to have monopolies over seeds and life forms worldwide. Interesting other combination is the same companies that control the seed and biotechnology commercially today are companies that control agrochemicals, and they're companies that control medicine and pharmaceuticals. So they're talking about very large-scale control over life. As an aside, let me just sort of say, you know, I switched to Fox News today, and I find the real place to figure out this country is to go to Fox News. And so Fox News, you know, he's trying to talk about all the places where Obama is going to go wrong. He says, oh, he wants to tax the rich. And the person he was interviewing, a senator, talked about somebody who had proposed a 90% tax on the super rich earlier, not now, 20, 30 years ago. So you want 90% tax? He says, no, I don't want a 90% tax, but we have to have a higher tax for those who are richer than for those who are not. Of course, the interesting thing that never comes up is how did they get rich in the first place? Yeah? Basically by taxing society, by all kinds of means, including privatization of life. If just sitting back, buying up companies, a Monsanto can take over the entire seed supply of a country like India, there's no limit to their wealth. Their profits increased 100% last year. On top of it, they increased the price of corn seed. I think it went up from $200 a bag to $300 a bag in the middle of the crisis. But what does it cost to a small farmer in India? Well, the only GM crop that's been allowed so far in India is cotton, partly because I filed cases in the early days. We don't have any GM food. But the BT cotton, which is this cotton which has a BT gene in it of Bacillus thuringiensis, it has become a monopoly supplier in the areas where cotton is grown. And in the decade, in the last decade of the introduction of hybrid cotton seed and now BT cotton seed, we have had 200,000 farmer suicides. 200,000. Why are the farmers of India committing suicide? And most of these suicides are in the BT cotton belt, where the GM, Monsanto's GM cotton is sold. For those of you who want to get more detail, we have a report called Seeds of Suicide, and I have small references to it in my book, Earth Democracy. When the seed costs go up, nearly 100 times is where it went, and then again legal cases by us brought it down. But not just the price of seed, the fact that seed which you had every year, because it's a renewable source, now you have to buy it every year because it's been made non-renewable. You can imagine how it changes the peasant economy. So farmers get into debt. And meantime, the Cargills of the world, using all the subsidies from your tax money. I think the next democratic revolution will have to be about public taxes and how they're used. Will they be used to bail out banks and give CEOs new, what do they walk away with? Bonuses. Yeah. They got bonuses out of that bailout. Will they be used as subsidies for agriculture, for dumping agricultural products, you know? Last year, suddenly, the apples on the streets of India were no more from Jammu and Kashmir, which is our apple area. They were from Washington. You know, to travel that far, you need huge amounts of export incentives for the Washington apple to travel so hard, poor thing.
You're listening to a talk by Dr. Vandana Shiva, a physicist, social activist, and environmentalist from India, who spoke at Washington State University on Wednesday, November 5th, 2008.
That's what I'm talking about.
KRFP, Moscow, Idaho.
Cotton alone gets $4 billion subsidies in this country. Overall, in the rich countries, the agricultural subsidy is $400 billion. That's more than $1 billion a day. That's what's causing hunger and the food crisis worldwide. Because when a commodity is dumped, farmers don't produce locally anymore. First year, the farmers get wiped out. The second year, the other people who depend on the farmers don't have anything. Overall, if you really look at it, what's happening is production itself is being attacked. So we have a crazy model of trade that assumes as long as we are swapping things around, something will happen, growth will happen. And of course, growth of the Wall Street kind happens, because when a Cargill comes to India and picks up wheat at $60, it causes scarcity in India, and then it brings back that same wheat and sells it at $240, something that did happen in 2002. So Cargill ended up with $180 profit on every ton of wheat. For the poor of India, there was a doubling of prices. For the government of India, there was a loss of $180 multiplied by 2 million. That was the import of that year. All this global swapping is ultimately creating a structure which is pushing out the farmers, and of course the US farmers have been pushed out over a longer period of time. In countries like India, in countries like China, which account for half the world's population, half the world's farmers, India accounts for every fourth farmer alive in the world today. 70% of our people farm. But one trigger, one sneeze in the Chicago futures trading, one sneeze in Wall Street can take out, sniff out the life of millions and millions of farmers, but also millions of poor people whose entire economic entitlement changes. If you are poor and are eating one meal a day, when food prices double, all you can do is eat half a meal a day. And that's what's accounts for the growing malnutrition, especially of women and children in the third world. I'm sure the people among you who are looking at, at those issues, but at the root of it is the fact that food production is being made unviable deliberately by distorted policy. How could it be unviable? It's working with the earth and producing something everyone needs. Agriculture is one economic activity that should never, ever become unviable. But an industrial system controlled by global corporations is making it totally unviable. Now, it doesn't have to be that way, because an agriculture that is ecological and biodiverse, I do think the wonderful rolling hills of this place could do with a little more than wheat. Well, maybe I should tell you then about the third sneeze. Yeah, the Green Revolution, first sneeze, the World Trade Organization, second sneeze. Cargill wrote the agriculture agreement. Literally, go to the records, Cargill vice president deputed to be the head of the US delegation to write the agreement that then dominated the rest of the world. Today, that agreement is not going through. Partly because, you know, we bring all this data to our government to say every year our farmers are losing $25 billion because of falling prices, 200,000 farm suicides. How can you continue to agree to a trading system where our farmers are being annihilated? So now India has had to say we won't allow our farmers to be killed. So what does the US do? It now goes round WTO, and there's a bilateral. It was signed on the same day when the nuclear deal was signed. It's called the US-India Agriculture Agreement. It's actually called the Knowledge Agreement of Agriculture. but it's basically an agriculture agreement. And it has had two big pushes. Making India buy wheat from the United States. We don't need to buy it, that's why it's forced trade. And deregulating our biotechnology system, our biosafety system of genetically engineered crops. In the case of wheat, the Cargill wheat was so bad that India's health standards, even after being diluted twice with arm twisting, couldn't be imported. So the Australians got the bid, but it was supposed to come to Cargill. Finally, Cargill did get one shipment. Again, I had to go, I mean, I constantly have to go to the court to deal with many of these things besides the grassroots movement. And now this whole wheat import issue has been stalled, both because of our cases as well as the fact that the international prices of wheat has shot up so high that no amount of justification can allow India to import from the US wheat with 17 weed infestations, pesticide residues way beyond our allowed limits, permissible limits, and wheat so bad that some of the local government agencies that were distributing it to the poor had to put unfit for eating. They could not sell it to the poorest of the poor in the country. That's how bad that wheat is. Now, of course, wheat will get rotten if it sits in those huge silos and rotting ships. And if you look at the standards of exports, you know, you're allowed to mix sawdust and nails this percent and rat droppings this percent. It's all allowed. I think that is probably what is one of the big issues we have to deal with, that food has been turned into a commodity and has lost the reverence we should have for it, the reverence that allows us to care for food, that allows us to have good food, that allows us to know the difference between good food and bad food, that allows everyone to get food to eat. Because if every other species on this planet has a natural right to food, should not the human species, that one among them all, also have a right to be part of the food web and not be defined out of it just because people don't fit into this profit-driven system? The system itself has generated the triple crisis we face. Last year, the big crisis around the time Al Gore and the IPCC got the climate award for peace, it was all about the climate, yeah? Most serious crisis, climate. And by this March, April, it was all about food, the food crisis. And a few months later, it was the financial crisis. All three are intimately linked. They're intimately linked. And agriculture that requires huge amounts of fossil fuels, chemical inputs, totally non-renewable, is an agriculture that requires huge amounts of financial systems, a credit-based system. It turns a farmer from being a producer into being a consumer of toxics. And it turns all of us from being healthy biological bodies to being dump yards for toxics. The climate crisis is also very closely related to all of this. Nitrogen fertilizers account for 60% of nitrogen dioxide emissions. The overall industrial agriculture, globalized agriculture, accounts for 25 to 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions. We've just in the village where we have our organic farm, where I do teaching and training in Dehradun. 2 years ago, a chicken factory came up at the other end. And when the wind blows to our direction, you can't sit anymore. That gas that stinks is called methane. It only gets produced in factory farming situations and when animals are grain-fed. Chicken weren't meant to live on a corn diet. Cows weren't meant to live on a bean diet. They were meant to eat grass. Between nitrogen oxides, methane, and carbon dioxide, And nitrogen oxide is 300 times more destabilizing as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. We've got a huge chunk of the climate problem in industrial globalized agriculture, but we have a huge chunk of the climate solution in ecological agriculture with higher levels of food sovereignty, higher levels of local self-reliance in food supply. We'll have to do this anyway because of peak oil. The interesting thing is, 3 days ago, even the oil industry had to release its reports that they are drilling less than they ever have. They don't have enough oil. Production has gone into the negative. But have you noticed that even while production is falling, the prices are also falling? Normal economics, supply demand, yeah? Things become scarce, price should go up. Things become, you have more, price should go down. It's not working anymore, not in agriculture, not in oil. But oil is running out. And we cannot run an agricultural system that assumes fossil fuel availability forever. And you can't imagine an agricultural system which grows the corn and soya to keep running that agricultural system as biofuel. Just doesn't work out. No matter how far you go and how much you expand, you have four crops that are expanding: corn, soya, canola, cotton. Soya is invading the Amazon. After the Amazon, what? It's a system that cannot generate food security for this planet, cannot generate climate security, and it can definitely not generate economic security. Over the last 20 years, I have tried to build on the best of knowledge available in agricultural communities. And we have worked on a model that is not chemically intensive, but is biologically intensive. Because you're always told intensive agriculture feeds the world. It's not intensive in a food way or a nutritional way. It's intensive only in terms of how much chemicals you can put into it. But more chemicals does not mean more food. It just means more disease. Our farmers are earning 10 times more than the farmers growing genetically engineered BT cotton or growing food with chemicals, the organic farmers. And it's natural, First, they're not spending anything on external input, so you have a huge savings. And secondly, you're producing more. You're actually producing more. Except that, of course, with diversity, the production goes up even higher. There's a one-to-one correspondence of production and biodiversity. The more biodiversity on your farm, the more food production you have. And the reason this was not noticed is because of the monoculture of the mind. The monoculture of the mind can only look at single commodities. Global trade can only deal with 4 or 5 commodities, but we have eaten 8,500 plants. We have all of that available to continue to give us food. Our Cargill cannot deal with 8,500 commodities. They'll go crazy. But a farmer can grow 250. Our farmers grow 250, 300 plants in beautiful interaction, in beautiful cooperation, in beautiful synergy. So you reduce financial expenditure, increase farmers' income, increase food production, reduce greenhouse gases, increase the adaption of agriculture to climate chaos. You're solving all the crises by doing the right thing for the planet. Just living the right way. Conserving biodiversity, growing food with care, giving it and sharing it with care. If Barack Obama can win an election in this country when everything was designed to not let it happen, I am sure we can see in the next few years a shift from monocultures to diversity in agriculture. We can see a shift from chemical agriculture to ecological farming. We can, if regulation of the financial system has become fashionable again, I do think it should be possible to think of regulating the genetic engineering industry as a possibility. We shouldn't imagine it's beyond our capacity. It is time for change. It's your time. I mean, that's what the election showed. It's really the young people who made this change, participating for the first time in electoral democracy in this country. But that's just the beginning. Because you put Barack Obama as a presidential candidate and got him to victory because you have other dreams. And I know for many of you, the dream of sustainability is a huge dream. The dream of justice is a huge dream. And I think that will be the challenge. That will be the challenge. And, you know, people think the corporations are so big, they're going to influence. Every time people say, but how can you deal with them? I say, they've made our lives so easy. There are only five of them. Yeah? There are five grain giants and there are five seed giants. There's 10 of them we have to deal with. Yeah? You had an entire army that declared that to be American, you had to be white. Yeah? Sarah Palin even said there's only one really American state in this country. You know, just as much as the elections were about diversity, the future of this planet is about diversity, and just as much as these elections were about knowing that change comes from the commitment, will, and determination of people who will not trade their freedom away, will not trade their joys away. That's what really touched me about the Chicago rally yesterday. You know, people were crying with joy. They were crying with joy. Americans had been brought back to the human community and the earth community. And we celebrate that. Because for me, the challenge now, the challenge after Obama enters the White House, is going to be to not just have him captured by the same interest groups that have captured the White House all these years, starting from the days of the Green Revolution. That was times of Lyndon Johnson. You know, the year he passed the bill for the blacks to be able to vote is the year he forced chemicals on India's agriculture. We shouldn't forget that. I think the challenge now is for us to genuinely practice an earth democracy. And the blocks at least have been removed. The first blocks have been removed. Got to remove the next blocks. Because agriculture has been globalized, the agricultural solutions, the food security solutions will come out of global solidarity. Not out of globalizing the food trade, but out of globalizing the knowledge about what it is to be good stewards of the land, to be good keepers of seed and good growers of food. And I hope some of you will come visit us at our School of the Seed. And I think, you know, you're so far away, we are so far away, it could be a good long trip. Thank you.
You've been listening to a talk by Dr. Vandana Shiva, a physicist, social activist, and environmentalist from India, who spoke at Washington State University on Wednesday, November 5th, 2008.